I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The court considers that Israel is under an obligation to agree to and facilitate relief schemes provided by the United Nations and its entities, including UNRWA.
The International Court of Justice has ruled Israel as an occupying power must allow UN aid into Gaza, and that Israel cannot use starvation as a method of warfare. We'll go to Jordan to speak with UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees. Then Secretary of State Marco Rubio heads to Israel, where Vice President J.D. Vance has been holding meetings on the future of Gaza.
We actually see this as an opportunity to build on the Abraham Accords. I think this Gaza deal is a critical piece of unlocking the Abraham Accords. But what it could allow is an alliance structure in the Middle East that perseveres, that endures.
We'll speak to longtime U.S. diplomat Robert Malley, co-author of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. Then to the New York mayoral race, Zoran Mamdani and Andrew Cuomo sparred in the final debate before early voting begins.
And the city has been getting screwed by the state, and that has to change, and the city has to be doing better.
We just had a former governor say in his own words that the city has been getting screwed by the state. Who was leading the state? It was you!
Governor Hochul!
You were leading the state for
Governor
10 years!
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The International Court of Justice has ordered Israel to restore access to the United Nations to deliver food and other basic necessities into the Gaza Strip. The advisory opinion from the UN's top court also found Israel had not provided evidence to back its claims that the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA, lacked neutrality or that a significant number of its staff members were members of Hamas. Yuji Iwasawa is president of the International Court of Justice.
In its final section on international humanitarian law, the court explains that custom international law prohibits the use of starvation of the civilian population as a method of warfare.
Israel condemned Wednesday's ruling, said it would not abide by the court's instructions. The Trump administration also condemned the opinion, with the State Department declaring it, quote, another corrupt ruling by the ICJ, unquote. In Gaza, an Israeli drone killed a Palestinian in Khan Yunis earlier today. Officials in Gaza say nearly 100 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli attacks since the U.S. brokered truce went into effect October 10th. Meanwhile, Palestinians in central Gaza on Wednesday interred the bodies of 54 unidentified Palestinians handed over by Israel in a mass grave. Many of the bodies showed clear signs of torture and execution. This is Rami Al-Farah, who tried and failed to confirm if his cousin's body was among those handed over by Israel Wednesday.
The signs of torture and brutal treatment on the body did not allow us to tell whether it was him or not. Our message and our demands to the world are to provide us with the means by which we can determine whether this person belongs to us or to someone else. The Israeli army knows these bodies are connected to people, but instead of names, they put out numbers. They left something harsh in our hearts, feelings of grief. Honestly, It's hard to bury a body when you don't know whether it's the right one or not.
Israel's Knesset has advanced legislation to apply Israeli sovereignty to all settlements in the occupied West Bank, a move that would effectively annex territory Palestinians want for a future state. The move prompted rare criticism from U.S. officials, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who departed for Israel Wednesday in a bid to prevent the U.S. brokered Gaza ceasefire from further unraveling. Rubio's trip comes on the heels of visits by Vice President J.D. Vance and Special Envoy Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner. Earlier today, Vance said he was personally insulted by the annexation vote, which came during his visit.
It was a very stupid political stunt, and I personally take some insult to it. The West Bank is not going to be annexed by Israel. The policy of the Trump administration is that the West Bank will not be annexed by Israel. That will continue to be our policy. And if people want to take symbolic votes, they can do that. But we certainly weren't happy about it.
Separately, Israel's Supreme Court Wednesday further delayed ruling on a petition calling on Israel to allow foreign reporters access to Gaza. The Foreign Press Association said it was disappointed by the additional month-long delay, which it blasted as a stalling tactic. Meanwhile, a group of 27 Democratic lawmakers has written to Secretary of State Rubio and U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee, urging them to secure the release of Mohammed Ibrahim, a teenage Palestinian-American citizen from Florida. He was arrested by Israeli soldiers who blindfolded and handcuffed him during an early morning raid on his family's West Bank home in February. Ibrahim spent his 16th birthday in an Israeli prison where he's been held without charge for nearly 8 months. The Pentagon confirmed Wednesday the U.S. launched strikes against two vessels in the Pacific off the coast of Colombia, killing five people and claimed without evidence the boats were carrying drugs. This follows seven strikes on alleged drug boats in the Caribbean. In the past month, at least 37 people have been reportedly killed in international waters in U.S. strikes. In response, Colombia's President Gustavo Petro said, quote, "It's murder. Whether in the Caribbean or Pacific, the U.S. government's strategy breaks the norms of international law," he said. President Trump met with NATO Secretary Mark Rutte at the White House Wednesday, shortly after the Trump administration and the European Union announced new sanctions on Russia's largest oil and gas companies. The announcement came as Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Trump's proposal to freeze the current front lines in the war is, quote, "a good compromise," unquote. Meanwhile, Ukraine launched a strike against a Russian chemical plant on Tuesday using British long-range cruise missiles. The Wall Street Journal's reporting the Trump administration's lifting restrictions on Ukraine's use of such weapons, allowing it to strike targets deeper inside Russia. This comes as the Norwegian Refugee Council's warning millions of Ukrainian civilians could be left without heat, water, and electricity this winter due to Russian attacks on energy infrastructure. In the United States, federal government shutdown has entered its 23rd day. As a result, 60,000 aviation safety workers won't receive a full paycheck in the coming days. The authority that operates the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport is planning to provide non-perishable food items to federal workers who are struggling to buy groceries. Meanwhile, the National Nuclear Security Administration, the agency which oversees the nation's nuclear stockpile, has announced it's furloughed more than 1,400 workers, three-quarters of its staff. On Capitol Hill, the Senate's 12th attempt to end the shutdown failed Wednesday. Ahead of the vote, Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon delivered a 22-hour speech warning about President Trump's agenda.
Colleagues, I'm coming tonight to the floor of this Senate to ring the alarm bells because we have become an authoritarian nation over the last 9 months. We are deep into an authoritarian takeover.
The Trump administration's dispatching more than 100 federal agents to the San Francisco Bay Area as it seeks to ramp up immigration raids in Northern California. That's according to the San Francisco Chronicle, which reports the deployment is a likely precursor to President Trump deploying National Guard troops to San Francisco. California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom blasted the deployment as, quote, "right out of the dictator's handbook," unquote. In Illinois, Protesters confronted masked federal agents Wednesday as they carried out multiple arrests in Chicago's Little Village neighborhood and the bordering suburb of Cicero. The agents were joined by Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino, whose forces were recently reprimanded by a federal judge for violating a prior court order restricting the use of tear gas and other less lethal weapons on peaceful demonstrators, journalists, and clergy. Federal agents fired pepper spray at protesters who witnessed a car crash involving federal agents.
They are thugs, and they could do whatever they want, and they crashed into an individual, arrested him with no probable cause, no warrant, and instead of the police department assisting the guy that got crashed, seeing if you need medical attention, they arrested him.
Here in New York, protesters marched Wednesday in solidarity with the street vendors who were harassed and detained Tuesday by federal agents during immigration sweeps targeting Manhattan's Canal Street. This is Awa Ngam, a street vendor and U.S. citizen originally from Mauritania who witnessed a friend's arrest by ICE agents. She was ordered to show ID proving her immigration status.
I always felt safe in America. I feel safe. I love coming to America. America is losing that. It's losing that. And people have to say something. They have to not be scared. They have to stand up. The time is now.
Meanwhile, a Cuban man deported by the Trump administration to the southern African kingdom of Eswatini has gone on hunger strike to protest his imprisonment in a maximum security prison there. Roberto Mosquera del Paral is among 11 so-called third country deportees sent by the Trump administration to Eswatini, despite legal challenges by human rights groups who've called the deportations a violation of U.S. and international law. The North Carolina House of Representatives has approved a new congressional map that could give Republicans an extra seat in Congress. According to state law, North Carolina's governor, Democrat Josh Stein, cannot veto the redistricting plan. President Trump praised North Carolina's map on social media last week, saying it would give voters in the state, quote, the opportunity to elect an additional MAGA Republican in the 2026 midterm elections, unquote. It follows a similar effort by Texas Republicans earlier this year when lawmakers passed a congressional map that could give Texas's congressional delegation up to five more House seats. A month later, the Republican-controlled Missouri state legislature passed a congressional map that would turn Democratic Representative Emanuel Cleaver's district into a Republican-leaning seat. In labor news, the New York Times reporting Amazon's planning to replace more than 500,000 jobs with robots. The company's internal documents also reveal Amazon's robotics team plans to automate 75% of the company's operations. A Senate report released earlier this month, spearheaded by Senator Bernie Sanders, warned artificial intelligence and automation could destroy nearly 100 million jobs over the next decade. Peru's interim president, Jose Heri, is declared a 30-day state of emergency after weeks of anti-government protests led to the impeachment of the previous president. The state of emergency in Peru gives the government the power to send the army to patrol the streets and curb the right to protest. Peruvians had been demonstrating over the rise in organized crime and extortion. Over the past month, more than 200 people were injured in the protests. And White House officials say the entire West Wing of the White House will be demolished for the Golden Gilded Ballroom, which President Trump said yesterday will now cost $300 million, up from $250 million, which is up from $200 million. That's despite this pledge made by President Trump in July.
It won't interfere with the current building. It won't be. It'll be near it, but not touching it, and pays total respect to the existing building, which I'm the biggest fan of. It's my favorite.
The East Wing's demolition comes as the National Trust for Historic Preservation has asked the Trump administration to pause construction until the National Capital Planning Commission has completed its review of the project. In a letter, the trust said it was concerned the proposed 90,000-square-foot ballroom will, quote, overwhelm the White House itself, unquote. since the White House is 55,000 square feet. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. The International Court of Justice has ruled that Israel, as an occupying power, must allow UN aid into Gaza and that Israel cannot use starvation as a method of warfare. Yuji Iwasawa, the president of the International Court of Justice, read the ruling Wednesday.
The court considers that Israel is under an obligation to agree to and facilitate relief schemes provided by the United Nations and its entities, including UNRWA.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, "This is a very important decision, and I hope Israel will abide by it." This is Paul Reichler, one of the attorneys representing Palestine at the ICJ.
So on the one hand, you have the court finding that starvation as a method of civilians, as a method of warfare, is illegal, it's prohibited. And on the other, the court found that Israel deliberately prevented food from reaching the civilian population in Gaza. I don't see how a reasonable person, certainly acting in good faith, could then say that Israel has complied with its international legal obligations. Plainly, it has not.
Israel condemned Wednesday's ruling and said it would not abide by the court's instructions. The Trump administration also condemned the opinion. We go now to Amman Jordan to speak with Tamara Al-Rafai. She is spokesperson and director of external relations for UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Tamara. Can you describe what's happening on the ground? How much aid, how many trucks is Israel allowing in? And what about UNRWA in particular, which it has banned?
The most important thing for us at UNRWA to reiterate is that we're the largest humanitarian agency in action in Gaza, and we have never stopped providing medical assistance, managing the shelters, disposing of solid waste, pumping and trucking clean drinking water throughout this conflict, and despite the ban by the government of Israel on international staff. 12,000 Palestinian staff members of UNRWA, men and women, have continued to work in Gaza, and that is why our services never stopped, even though international personnel and the goods, the supplies, the foods, the hygiene kits, the tents of UNRWA have been banned of going into Gaza. So for the last 10 days, and with the ceasefire, the fighting has subsided in many parts, which has allowed a lot of people in Gaza to start moving back to check in on their homes. But more than 90% of housing units in Gaza are destroyed, and these people are going to need immediate, urgent shelter and shelter material, including winter clothes and blankets, in the coming few weeks. Meanwhile, although the agreement calls for 600 trucks per day of food and other humanitarian supplies, what we've seen in the last few days is certainly an easing, so a slight increase in the number of trucks going in, but we're way, way, way below the 600. So yesterday, 281 trucks went in. On Monday, 263. That's less than half of 600.
So, Tamara, do you think that the opinion by the International Court of Justice is likely to have any effect and more trucks may be able to get in?
This is the highest legal authority of the UN, and it's provided its advisory opinion, based on a request by the UN General Assembly, which represents the international community. So there is a global buy-in for the course, the path that this court has gone through, and of the opinion. While the opinion itself is not binding, the opinion confirms Israel's obligation under international law, which also, we hope, will increase pressure on the government of Israel to allow more humanitarian supplies and international personnel, including of UNRWA, because we remain the largest in Gaza, to go in.
And Tamara, but could you respond, one probably can't be too optimistic about what the effect of this advisory opinion is, because as you said, it's non-binding. There are no direct penalties for non-compliance. And then, you know, Israel's foreign ministry rejected the opinion outright, saying that it was political and said it would not cooperate with UNRWA. And Israel's UN ambassador, Danny Danon, blasted the opinion on UNRWA as, quote, shameful. So your response?
The response is this opinion could not substantiate any of the Israeli allegations against UNRWA and UNRWA personnel. So the opinion is unambiguous. It's an opinion by the highest legal authority of the UN. Now, again, we are in a realm of international relations and the pressure that can be exercised in order for an adequate amount of humanitarian supplies, food, medicines to go into Gaza is as good as the pressure that the international community can exercise for the actioning of that opinion. So while the opinion itself is non-binding, it says a lot about violations of international law and about the impact of the restriction of humanitarian assistance. I mean, famine was declared at the end of August in Gaza. It says a lot about the impact of these actions, particularly against UNRWA, by the government of Israel on the civilians in Gaza.
So if you could respond to what the White House is saying in the State Department. The State Department, as President Trump and Secretary Rubio worked tirelessly to bring peace to the region, this so-called court issues a nakedly politicized, non-binding advisory opinion, unfairly bashes Israel, and gives UNRWA a free pass for its deep entanglement and material support for Hamas terrorism. Your response, Tamara?
The advice itself, the opinion itself, says that such claims are not substantiated. But more importantly, if this peace plan is to succeed, then bringing in stability to Gaza, bringing in respite, bringing in flooding Gaza with humanitarian assistance are all key to the success of this plan. Everybody wants this plan to succeed. Everybody wants peace in Gaza and for what happened to never happen again, whether it's the horrific attacks of the 7th of October or the devastating conflict and destruction that followed it. And in that sense, allowing the largest aid agency, the one that's most experienced in Gaza, not only in distributing food, but I mean, what we do is closer to what the public sector does. We run health clinics. We run schools. We want to bring back over 600,000 traumatized children into learning and schooling and take them away from what could be a lost generation. For this plan to succeed, UNRWA has to be able to play its role in Gaza because no other humanitarian agency has the scale and scope of our 12,000 personnel, our warehouses, our teachers, our facilities, and mostly the trust of the community.
Finally, where is the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, this shadowy, controversial U.S.-Israeli-backed aid, so-called aid group, now that the international organizations are back, horrifying the world as it opened fire on people seeking food? Has it just disappeared?
Thankfully, the GHF is nowhere to be seen or heard of since that plan kicked in. And that is why, for the success of that plan, especially the humanitarian element of it, which calls for a much increased number of trucks and aid and medicines and whatnot into Gaza, for that to succeed, the UN, the humanitarian international system, the international NGOs, and at their helm, UNRWA, have to be able to play that role.
We want to thank you, Tamara Rafai, spokesperson, director of external relations for UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, speaking to us from Amman, Jordan. Up next, longtime U.S. diplomat Robert Malley, co-author of Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, death, and the pursuit of peace in Israel-Palestine. Then we'll come back home to New York to the last debate of mayoral candidates. Stay with us.
Well, I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. Woke up this morning with my mind. My mind
set on freedom.
Oh, yes, I'm walking.
Woke up this morning with my mind stayed on freedom by the Resistance Revival Chorus performed at Town Hall in September for Voices for Gaza. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is heading to Israel today, following on the heels of Vice President J.D. Vance's visit. Vance was in Israel to discuss the future of Gaza and implementing the next steps of the U.S.-brokered ceasefire. During Vance's visit, Israel's Knesset advanced legislation to annex the occupied West Bank. Earlier today, Vance said he was, quote, personally insulted by the annexation vote.
It was a very stupid political stunt, and I personally take some insult to it. The West Bank is not going to be annexed by Israel. The policy of the Trump administration is that the West Bank will not be annexed by Israel. That will continue to be our policy. And if people want to take symbolic votes, they can do that. But we certainly weren't happy about it.
We're joined now by Robert Malley, former U.S. senior Middle East official under Presidents Clinton, Obama, and Biden, co-author of the new book, Tomorrow is Yesterday, Life, Death, and the Pursuit of Peace in Israel-Palestine. He wrote the book with Hussein Agha, who has been a negotiator on behalf of the Palestinians. Robert Malley is a lecturer at Yale University, the former president of the International Crisis Group. Thanks so much for being with us. Can you start off by just assessing where this ceasefire is now? What is the first stage? We just are seeing a parade of U.S. officials. Vance was there following up on Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And now you have, of course, Rubio arriving in Israel.
Yeah, I think some in the Israeli press are calling this babysitting. So, listen, there's parts of this plan that are, you know, terrible. And I could spend hours trying to eviscerate the plan in terms of its sort of neocolonial aspects of deciding everything for Palestinians without Palestinians having a voice and allowing Israel to remain in Gaza and to decide when and how it will withdraw. So, again, there's so much to be said against it. That said, so far, it appears to have ended the slaughter, much of the slaughter, most of the slaughter, and allowed, as we just heard, some humanitarian assistance to come in, and the hostages and Palestinian captives were released. So that's something that President Trump's predecessor had not been able to achieve. The next phase is, you know, we'll see. There's many reasons to be skeptical, to be pessimistic. The plan is vague, ambiguous. Again, it gives a lot of the keys to Israel to decide what and if it will do anything. But one step at a time, I think it's at least good to see that the guns have fallen mostly quiet for now.
Well, the U.S. officials who've been there this week and Rubio en route now are ostensibly there to discuss the implementation of the second phase of Trump's 20-point ceasefire plan. So if you could talk about prospects for the second phase, which include establishing a transitional government in Gaza, deploying an international stabilization force, the disarmament of Hamas, and the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. There have been no dates set yet for any of this, but now these discussions will be underway. Is that correct?
I mean, that's the American plan. And again, it seems that that's what they want to do. They want to, and they seem, you know, the Trump administration seems to be extremely focused. We mentioned how many of the senior officials are there. But each of these phases that you mentioned are full of obstacles. I mean, is Hamas really going to disarm? Why would they disarm when obviously they still face, they believe they face security threats, and they also want to continue to be the de facto authority in Gaza? Is Israel really going to withdraw? Are they going to be prepared to have an international stabilization force? Neither side really wants that. Hamas doesn't want to have a force that is going to be there to, maybe to disarm it. Israel doesn't particularly like having a third party that's going to be interposed between it and the Palestinians because it wants to be free to do whatever it wants in Gaza. So I think we're going to see obstacle after obstacle. It doesn't sound like they have a concrete plan and know how to implement it. But again, I would take it one step at a time. And if all that is achieved is the end to the worst of the bloodshed, I'd give credit to the Trump administration to have done that. The rest of the plan is not just vague and ambiguous. There's a lot not to like about it.
And talk about the battle over the corpses. Israel has just returned dozens of corpses of Palestinian prisoners. The Gaza health